The James Beard Foundation is a nonprofit with the mission to celebrate, nurture, and honor chefs and other leaders making America's food culture more delicious, diverse, and sustainable for everyone. And right now, it's working to respond to the dire situation the food and beverage community is in due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Restaurants, bars, and other independent food and beverage operations are often on the front lines of community revival. The majority of culinary community businesses have less than 500 employees, but collectively, this industry generates $1 trillion a year, 60 of which is pumped back into their local business communities. To help bring swift economic relief to these essential businesses, the James Beard Foundation launched a fund to provide microgrants to independent food and beverage businesses in need. You can donate today at jamesbeard.org/relief.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurda, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Good evening, again. Welcome to the 32nd episode of Origins. And we're thrilled to have an Origins alumni tonight, Bernie Herman. Bernie was our 10th, here for our 10th Origins in 2016. So, and since that time, he has published this wonderful book, which is for sale tonight for $29. It's called The South You Never Ate. And I don't want to take any home with me, so buy them. So let me just give a little brief introduction about Bernie. Was anybody here for that last one? Wow. Okay, good. Good. All right. Well, our featured panelist tonight is Bernie Herman, and he's one of the co-founders of the Eastern Shore Virginia Foodways, along with a few other folks that I wanted to recognize. Tom Gallivan from Shooting Point Oysters, Heather Terry Lusk from Sewanscott Oysters, Mills Winner from Chatham Vineyards, and Amy Brandt, a local chef. So Bernie is the, this is a very long title, so bear with me. George B. Tyndall, Distinguished Professor of Southern Studies and Folklore at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he works on the material cultures of everyday life and the ways in which people furnish, inhabit, communicate, and understand the world of things. His interests extend to a larger universe of material culture, including vernacular architecture, which I'm not really sure what that is, but he'll tell us, contemporary quilts and quilt making, food histories, and contemporary art by self-taught makers. His food writing has appeared in Savoir, Gravy, Organic Life, and Southern Cultures. His 2019 book, which I just referenced, The South You Never Ate, brings together over 100 recorded interviews on the foodways of Virginia's Eastern Shore as part of a larger endeavor undertaken around sustainable economic development through heritage foodways. He's currently working on a second volume, along with a book of edited essays on the art of an African of the African American South, of an African American South. His community engagement through public presentations, workshops, and exhibitions derives from a deeply held belief that work of the arts and humanities finds its first calling in the public square. So we're thrilled to have Bernie back in Baltimore, maybe the original Bernie. So take it away.
He took my name.
So welcome, Bernie.
Thanks for coming back.
Thank you. What an honor to be here.
Well, as Dana mentioned, the very first return Origins guest, and I couldn't imagine a better person to have that honor, I guess we'll call it. And I was a little late getting in here because I couldn't stop eating the clams that that Lauren made that were out of this book. But thank you. And I am so excited, and I think you can, the excitement in the room, the excitement as we were getting ready to come in was just palpable. It's great to experience that and great to have you here. And for me, a lot of that excitement comes from the fact that we have this book now. And that's the big thing that's changed since the last time you were here, is that this came out, and I am just so taken with this book. It's beautiful, it's important, and we're gonna talk a lot about it today, tonight. But I think as a way of starting the conversation and framing the conversation, I want you to talk a little bit about this place that this book is about. Because I think the title itself is kind of interesting and references the place. And I'd love to hear you describe before. There are so many things I want to dive into here, but to keep from getting ahead of myself, I want you to talk a little bit about the Virginia part of the Eastern Shore and just describe that place to us and how it came to be the subject of your book.
Oh, sure. Thanks. And first of all, thank you for inviting me back. It really is an honor to be here. I'm a huge fan of all the work that you've done and others have done to really bring a kind of awareness to the Eastern Shore of Virginia and its really extraordinary and little known foodways. The Eastern Shore of Virginia, for those of you who do not know, is not part of Maryland. Those of us who hail from down there like to think of it, Virginia's Eastern Shore. It is two counties that extend south from Maryland, and our only land connection is to Maryland. Where we are and where this book takes place is really about 3 to 4 miles wide of fast land or high ground. On one side are the Great Atlantic Marshes that reach out as much as 8 miles to a string of barrier islands. Those islands are known as migratory islands. They move with all kinds of climate and sea level changes. They are uninhabited, but they have been inhabited in the past. Imagine the Outer Banks of North Carolina with no people on them. That is what our Atlantic fringe looks like. On the western side, we have the Chesapeake Bay. And to give you a sense of what that's like is that we cannot see the rest of Virginia from where we live. We know it's out there on the far side of the curve of the earth. We have connections, but really it's a very different kind of place. The soils there are sandy and light. These are all in terms of the seaside and the lower Chesapeake Bay. These are some of the cleanest waters left in the eastern United States. Some of the highlights include the fact that it's the largest clam-producing grounds in the world. It has a history of human occupation that goes back thousands of years, but in this year as we recognize the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, one of the places they would have encountered in 1619 would have been the Eastern Shore of Virginia. It's a place that has a food history that is truly a coming together first peoples or indigenous foodways, European, and I don't mean just English. There are Dutch, Northern European, and other European traditions in play here, and of course West African foodways, and that's all in place by the 1630s, to give you a sense. And some of those dishes are still cooked regularly in family homes. More recently, we have seen huge changes, I think recently, first of all, in the 1880s. There was the arrival of the railroad and the opening of major markets for this area that is really quite isolated without rail or highway. And that opened up incredible possibilities in terms of things like sweet potatoes and the growing and marketing of sweet potatoes, white potatoes. This became one of the great truck farming areas of the mid-Atlantic. And now we're looking at another major change, which is the rise of a Spanish-speaking population, which has added one more layer of complexity and sophistication to local cuisines, including the arrival of such things as drumfish carnitas. I could never have imagined such a thing. The rise of gorditas as a food way that synthesizes multiple diverse Mexican and Central American practices. Is that enough or is that too much?
That's a good start. That's a good start.
I guess if it was too much, I can't take it back.
No, we're on our way. And that's, one of the things that strikes me about the place and the way that the book captures that place, it's a whole world unto itself. And I think if you're driving, you could drive down 13 and go across the bridge tunnel, which has, I'd love to hear about the impact that had. I guess that opened in like 1964 or so. And I'm sure that had a huge impact on what was previously a fairly isolated place, accessible mostly by ferry, I think, right? I mean, anyway. But what comes alive in this book in an incredible way is this whole world that is just off that corridor of Route 13, which is a lot of, gas stations and all that stuff that we see every day. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that world, because it's just, I've never seen it documented in such a, there's so much writing about food and foodways and cuisine and the culture but this one is, maybe because it's so kind of focused in a way, I don't know. Can you do something with that?
There's a lot to work with.
Okay,
there.
Good.
Okay. Let's start though with the part about isolation.
Yeah.
It's a really curious equation how that works, is that in many ways, the area, those two counties have been more isolated from Virginia until crossing the Chesapeake Bay
right.
than they were from Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. I know as a kid is that when we were at that point living on the Norfolk side, we would take the ferry back and forth. And it was, as I recall, 2 hours of diesel and drunks trying to beat an arcade machine, which in a pitching ferry boat is really an extraordinary thing to watch and will create a lifetime impression on a 5-year-old. But the railroad, which extended south, really provided a high-speed linkage, which solidified the connections to the big urban markets of Philadelphia, Baltimore, at that point, New York. And so it was really isolated in terms of commodity flows from the rest of Virginia.
Right.
And also as a place that just really had a kind of a static demographic for a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. The opening of Route 13 in terms of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel has really increased traffic. But that's exactly what it's increased, is traffic. And people just really flow, you know, move through this area and really don't get off of 13. And even if they did, it's still sort of hard to find your way around.
It is, yeah.
You would never know you're surrounded by water.
And so many other amazing things. And I have a vivid memory of encountering you as I was poking around in that area. I was down there looking for Tom Gallivan, and he's sometimes not the easiest guy to find. But we found him, and I happened to meet you that day, and I felt like a whole world kind of opened up to me. We came over to your spot, saw the fig trees, which we'll talk about in a bit, and just, you know, all of a sudden, the place started to really come alive. This was a place, I guess, at one time, that was two of the richest counties in Virginia, right?
Two of the richest counties east of the Mississippi. Made so, particularly in the Gilded Age, 1890s up to about 1925, through farming and a lesser extent through the shell fishery. But there is an entire economy that evolved out of the cultivation of potatoes, white potatoes, and their shipping. And when you go down, you'll see all these Victorian churches and houses that are still there, and people refer to those as potato churches or potato houses even now. And so you can really see that moment of prosperity on the landscape, and you can see the ways in which it vanished by the fact that so little followed it.
Right, and it was only a moment, and now it's gone. In a way, and you're looking for ways to kind of, try to find ways to bring prosperity and economic viability back to this place. That's part of what you do. What the what's the organization called?
Eastern Shore Virginia yes. Foodways, yes. Our little group.
Yes, many of whom are friends of mine, as you pointed out earlier. It's great to know people down there. So. The question I guess I wanted to get to before we really dive into the book is like what is there now? Like what are the ways that people are making their livelihoods now that the age of prosperity is gone?
It's limited, but it's changing. Is that really there is monoculture, and this is winter wheat, soybeans, field corn, and some cotton is grown there. The shell fishery has moved to aquaculture. The wild fishery is really pretty much a thing of the past. The shellfish you get, oysters, clams, almost all of that is now farmed. And that provides some measure of jobs. But beyond that, other than segments of the service industry, there's just not much there. There are a couple of spots. Cape Charles has become something of a tourist destination and a summer spot. One in a long succession. I was talking with somebody earlier about Wachapreg, which was like that 100 years ago. But for this, all intents and purposes, I really think the area is at a crossroads. And when I got together with folks and first started to think about this, I was really moved by a question that a friend of mine asked me years ago when we were looking at historic house interpretation. And we would tour the house, and then she would turn to the group, and she would say, "What song does this place sing best?" You can tell all kinds of stories, but what does it sing best? And I really looked at the Eastern Shore of Virginia, the part that I know as well as anything, I guess, and asked that question. And the song it sings best is the one that's always sung, which is about an extraordinary array of natural resources in terms of its fishery, these long histories of agriculture, the introduction of new cultivars, the rise of really localized foodways and recipes. And I began to think and started to talk with Tom and with Heather and Mills and Amy about what this would look like. And we began to think about this as the next emergent southern cuisine. if you think about it, the foodways on the eastern shore of Virginia are where they were for Charleston in the Lowcountry 50, 70 years ago, and where they were for New Orleans and the Bayou Country, you know, a century or more earlier than that. Each of those places had a real bare bones cuisine that then gets recognized and elaborated and explored, and that's exactly where we are now. We're at that point of discovery and exploration, and there, I think, is the song that that place sings best.
At the same time, you've described this to me as a cuisine of surpassing plainness. And it seems like an interesting place or an interesting subject for a book.
It is a plain cuisine. It is an unembroidered cuisine that is on the verge of the sort of a coming together. The spice profile there has pretty much been what it's been for the last four centuries. It's black pepper, salt, some sort of sweet, either molasses or sugar or something along those lines, and then savory, animal fat, those sorts of flavors. And then every now and then somebody would get really excited about nutmeg or cinnamon.
And a shipwreck would come wash the shores.
But, you know, within those, what they created was out of that cuisine, and I admit, I said it was a cuisine of surpassing plainness, but they're building blocks. Mm-hmm. It's a resource that's just there to be discovered and shared.
Well, I'm really impressed, and I think the book does a great job of kind of capturing the history up to and including the very present day. And as you mentioned, these layers and layers of different peoples and different cultures and contributions to this cuisine. As a starting point, I would love for you to read a little bit from the book, if you're up for that.
And
I have a spot that I'd like you for. If you have a spot, if you have something you want to read, but I have this passage. If you're are we on the same? We're on the same page. How'd that happen?
You mentioned this in the car.
Okay, good.
I was paying attention.
You obviously were. So it's this paragraph, and it goes right through to here.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Okay.
Taste is one of those words that covers a lot of territory and partitions it too. We think of taste in its physical sense as flavor, the play of sweet, salt, bitter, sour, and savory, unique to every ingredient and every dish. Taste in this sense is about bodily sensations. Taste also entails social knowledge. A connoisseur uses specific knowledge about food, wine, art, literature, and just about everything else to render acts of judgment. Taste in this iteration is about discernment and sensibility, and it is very much about creating and policing the borders of community and distinction. Taste, then, is on our tongues and in our minds and in how we comport our lives in the company of others. Terroir and cuisine make taste visible. Taste is a function of habit. It is learned and cultivated as something that is known through the body and measured in the mind. We could think of taste as the acts of knowing that lie at the crossroads of consumption and conversation, a posturing about what we eat and why we like it for high intellectual purpose. Or we could pine for a plate of black duck and dumplings and the grand universe of dumpling types and preferences found on the eastern shore of Virginia.
Which is like literally the perfect transition to segue to what I want to talk about next, which is dumplings. But I love this passage because it is kind of typical of the way that this book works. And you go from this very, what to me is a moving kind of meditation on taste, and you bring it right back to the very specific place that we're talking about, Eastern Shore, and then even more specifically to these dumplings. And this book is so good at getting into the nitty-gritty, into the very specific aspects of this cuisine. And it makes me, you know, other books that have tried to do this, and as you mentioned, other cuisines have been kind of explored, But I've never encountered a book that kind of takes the time to really, you know, make the distinctions, understand what's going on. And so in this case, there are, correct me if I'm wrong, two kind of main kinds of dumplings that are appreciated in this part of the world. And if you could just talk about dumplings for a second, because it's this has meant a lot to me, and I think our audience will get a lot from it.
All right, so we're in Baltimore. Yes. And you don't know this, but you're in a dumpling DMZ. And there are really two big dumpling traditions. There are the dumplings, which really can be tracked with close associations to, say, the interior of Pennsylvania. These are puff dumplings or like kugel or something like that. But these are dumplings that you make into little balls and drop them in, and they float and they cook in that way. Southern dumplings are slick dumplings or slippery dumplings. And this is a very lean dough that is rolled out very, very thin and then sliced into strips that are then added to a broth or a stew near the end and cook out at the very end of it. As my friend Buck Dowdy says in here, as he says, you want those dumplings so tight that when you bite into one, your teeth stick together. There are also sort of other kinds of dumplings in play here, and one of my favorite are the dumplings of peas and doughboys. Does anybody ever here had peas and doughboys? These are dumplings that are the size of English peas, and people would shell out peas, which are already sort of starchy, and the peas would be cooking. At the end, you would introduce these little tiny dumplings using a teaspoon into this, and this becomes then a very kind of thick mixture. The folks on the Eastern Shore of Virginia are very particular about their dumplings. There is no messing about. They will be quick to tell you what a good dumpling is and what a good dumpling is not, and often in direct disagreement with the person sitting next to them. And the differences are so fine. I was at the landfill one afternoon, and I never miss an opportunity. And a woman pulled up next to me, and I leaned over as she was emptying the garbage out of her truck, and I said, "You ever think about dumplings?" You know, and she says, "Well, yes, I do." Now, there are not many places in the world where you can get that question in a landfill and not expect to have a quick visit from the police for some sort of strange harassment. But she says, "No," and I said, "Really? Well, what kind do you like?" And she says, "Well, me and my sister really disagree on this." I said, "Well, really?" And she says, "Yes, I like those slippery dumplings, but they have to be very, very thin. And my sister likes them, but they don't have to be quite that thin. So my mama would make both kinds for us. It's the same dumpling out of the same dough. It's just rolled to a different thinness." And that then becomes a real point of connoisseurship in there. So dumplings, the most ordinary of things, one of the most ancient of foods, is right there, is something that is seen and valued and hardly ever gets discussed.
Amongst us, but apparently it's... Another thing about this, but I'm sorry I'm going off this book, but I'm very excited about the book. One of the things I love about it is you meet so many people, and a lot of the effect when you're reading it is like almost like you're sitting there and having dinner, or you're talking about these things. You've captured the voice and the love of food that people have. In that same chapter, you're talking about black duck and dumplings, and that long, what to me was a very long account of how this guy's mom would make it, the duck and the dumplings, and how it would boil, and how it would finally come together at that right moment, and it would get dark. It was just spectacular. And it made me want to, I haven't tried that particular dish. I don't think you have either. I think you said you're still waiting in that passage to try it, but it just made me want to, like, his description and the way you captured it, I was just like, oh my God, I've got to try that someday. But Anyway.
Come on.
Huh?
Let's make it happen.
We got to find some black duck. You had a couple at one point, apparently.
I did, and I had to give them up because I didn't feel like mess. Well, they weren't exactly legal black ducks, but I had nothing to do with that part. They just ended up in my possession. But there's the whole story about sort of trying to find a home for these orphan black ducks. It involves a Parisian fish chef. It involves a drowned person that shows up on our beach. It gets very involved. But yes, we do have some black ducks.
It seems to me that this is an incredible community. And the times that I've been down there, I've gotten this feeling that there's just almost a separate economy of, like you said, you know, all a neighbor visits and you're like, I'm going to give you these black ducks. And, you know, knowing Tom and the back and forth with clams and oysters and shellfish and figs in your case and all these other things. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, in spite of the fact that this isn't the richest place in Virginia or in the country, but there's just this food and the people that care about it have created this very special thing, and they kind of work together, and it feels very much like a great little community around food and beverage. In the case, you have Chatham and...
It is. It's the best way to think about it is about mutuality, about everybody is there for everybody else. You have to think about a place that's lost population every census since 1930, has the longest history of structural poverty in the state of Virginia, and is a food desert by virtue of distance from one of the two food lions in the county. And when Walmart came, that was like a real step up in the world of produce for us. It's amazing how little you can actually buy beyond a couple of produce stands. But except for February and March, it's really hard to go hungry here, and people are constantly giving each other what they have extra of. And there's a real sense of that. And it's never a sense of obligation. It's more like, hey, I got some of this. You want some? And they go, yeah. And so, for example, when I would go out with H.M. Arnold, gill netting on Nassauwattocks Creek, we would catch the fish that for the market, which I wouldn't touch, but the fish that were basically nobody wanted, things, this will kill you, Spanish mackerel,
not a market fish,
bluefish, I mean, all the fish, you know, that there's just not a real market for.
What were the fish he was selling?
Amazingly enough, the fish that he could always sell were spot and croaker or hardheads, but that was primarily into a local market. Mm-hmm. And he would just, people would call. But anyway, he would give these fish that nobody wanted, and I would take them home, and I would smoke them and put them up and then carry them back and would always give back. He would then give some of those smoked fish to somebody else who might have a surfeit of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know is you get some tomatoes that come out of this. And so there's sort of this sort of whole non-economy.
Right.
It's an economy of mutual concern. I don't want to over-romanticize it, but it's a very real thing. Uh-huh. Here.
I love that. And one of the things that stands out to me about this place, and it's an extraordinary part of the Lower Eastern Shore, and one of the things that drew me to it was the Hog Island Bay. And before I ever saw it, it was almost this mythological place because it was where these clams and oysters came from. And then I finally got, you know, when I went down and I met you and I met Tom, and we went out to Hog Island. And Hog Island itself has an incredible place in the cuisine and the history of the Lower Eastern Shore. And it almost, you know, almost to an international point now that you've established the Hog Island fig as part of the arc of slow food arc of taste, right?
Right.
Talk about that place, the bay and the island. You described it earlier as a barrier island, but it's so unusual, and I think you described it as like the Outer Banks, but without all the development, which is there's nothing out there. No sign of human habitation whatsoever.
Yeah, although there was village right. up until the hurricanes of 33 and 36.
Uh-huh.
And then people just had to move off the island. And they also took their houses with them, and some of them took their fig trees and grapes with them, too, and reestablished themselves in these little seaside villages. But the islands are so far offshore. You can see Smith Island when you come across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. But most of the ones, you know, they're out of sight. They're on the other side of the view shed that you're out there. And what has survived out there are cultivars that have gone feral. Figs have done well out there, including one of the oldest known strains of figs in British North America. And then there are other things. For example, they used to run livestock, including sheep, on the islands. And the sheep over several centuries evolved in ways that they are thirst tolerant. They would eat salt grass, and they grew to about half the size or so of a market sheep. But they are the American equivalent of Enyo Preysel, the famed sheep of or mutton of Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you would think that if you were to eat mutton from a seven-year-old animal, that it would be gamey, and this is a whole different category. And it's that kind of thing that we're real interested in building awareness around. And those islands really kept a lot of that going, just because they were not connected and not inhabited since the late 30s.
Mm-hmm. And is anybody bringing that sheep to market as mutton?
There are two folks who are thinking about this. The person who's doing the most work is Tom Gallivan, who ended up getting, I think, about a 50-acre farm. He's partitioned it and part of it into four meadows. He started with a small flock that is built up. Those sheep were almost vanished from the eastern shore of Virginia. I think there were three or four of them left. Where they had survived was at Mount Vernon and Monticello as the oldest North American sheep that you could find that was out there. So they, re-sheepified us. Tom is now, I think he's probably got about 50 or so. They're really quite wonderful beyond being tasty.
Mm-hmm.
His goal is to sort of build out a herd, I think, of about 70 or so for folks. Where it goes beyond that, there's another person who's been fooling around with it a bit further down the county, but has not really worked out what it would look like to scale. But there is now a Hog Island Sheep Company.
Oh, right on. News to me.
Hey, there it is. And you know who its CEO is? Is Danny Gallivan, who's 9.
Well, we'll have to wait a little bit then. I'm wondering what you'd think about this. You know, one of the things that I love about the food in this book, and, you know, I got to contribute a little bit, and I kind of let my imagination run a little bit. But it seems to me that the beauty of it is that it's not a limitless range of ingredients. It's not everything under the sun. It's specific things, again, that have that are in some sense from this place, of this place, and that's what kind of informs and I guess limits in some sense the cuisine. Is that, and to me that seems like a good thing, but counter to the world that we live in where everything's available all the time. Do you have a thought about that, or you know, what the kind of the inherent limitations, the isolation of the place, and what it can do, and all the things that it doesn't do, and what that has contributed to this?
You can grow most anything there. In fact, one of my neighbors has been growing West African Bene. And we have monitored it over the last 5 years, and it could be grown to scale as a cultivar. For those of you who don't know, Bene is a sesame seed. So it's West African sesame. It's a very almost earthy flavor to it. It's really quite lovely. So there, you can grow all kinds of things here. The mainstays, certainly since the 1880s on, have been truck crops, but those have all fallen aside with the death of the canneries. The things that are most distinctive to that area, though, are those that are associated with the sea and the bay. There are fish there.
Yeah.
And that's changing now, is that we see fish now that you never would have seen, and birds, too. When I was a kid, you never saw a pelican, and now they're sort of, you know, they're all over the place. The fish, though, that are really have local histories, black drum, are amazing. There are what we call toads or blowfish or puffer fish. They have been, I love the branding as sugar toads. Well, they are tasty. But there are other things that people don't eat, which I find really interesting. Eels. This is a place that has a lot of eels. There are a few people who still fish for them. They are all shipped either to the Netherlands or Tokyo. There are these trucks with these big aerated fish tanks that come through, pick up all the eels, and off they go.
Take them live.
Take them live.
Uh-huh.
They have to be shipped live. And then there are other things, these various kinds of white bait. And you've been out there haul seining for white bait and did very well.
Thanks.
With silver sides, grass shrimp.
Uh-huh.
So that's there. Blood arcs, the clam with hemoglobin. Are wild there. But there's also all these things that have global fans and no respect at home.
No local market. Yeah. Like the Spanish mackerel that you mentioned earlier. Yeah. It's a funny thing that happens. I think we see that a lot in our
I think the real equation, though, here, and the one that's so important, is there's a real connection between food and storytelling. Is it's not just about the ingredients or the preparations. It's about all the stuff that goes on around it. And so that almost any food becomes the occasion for some sort of story. Could I read one of my favorites,
please?
As this is, and this will give you an idea, because the other thing is the part that you heard me read before, that was my voice, and this book is not about my voice. This book is really about the voice of this place. And so this is about strawberries. Now, you would think strawberries. Strawberries are everywhere. Fine. How many of you all know that all the strawberries we know come from a single point of origin? There is a historical moment that is the birth of the modern strawberry. In the 1730s or early 40s in the northwest of France, the Europeans, totally frustrated at attempts to domesticate the wild strawberry, realize that there are wild North American strawberries, the Virginica, and wild South American strawberries, the Chileensis. So, of course, a French botanist says, what a great idea. Let's crossbreed these things. Now, you got to remember, this is like 1730s, 40s. Somebody gets this idea. But out of that becomes the strawberry for which all the varieties that we know until very recently have evolved. But strawberry picking time comes around Mother's Day at the same time as the soft shell crab first run, at the same time that wild asparagus, and the same time that the black drum all show. They mark the end of the season of want and the beginning of a season of plenty. But this also meant the first real kind of agricultural work of the year, where folks who were really doing day work and piecework could get in the fields. And the season was so short that labor was in high demand. So this is between Theodore Peed, who throws the annual turtle party at his house, and H.M. Arnold, one Euro-American, one African-American, greatest of friends. Theodore Peed relaxing with his great friend H.M. Arnold in the shade of the Bayford Oyster House on a breathtakingly hot August afternoon spoke of his own experiences in the strawberry fields. Peed nods to H.M. He don't know about strawberry fields, but damn if I don't. You get them suckers in the morning when everything is wet, and it's cold, too, because you start picking in May. Man, your hands down there will freeze, boy. And them, he always calls me boy. And them gnats come out of them bushes. Man, you'd be on fire, boy. Your hands were cold, and you'd be beating your hands on your body like your fingertips, trying to get them warm. I was going to school. Go to school. Fingertips was red. Them gnats, Peed chokes and coughs. They would burn your ass up, boy. You'd be out there in the strawberry field at daybreak, 9 o'clock. It was over with. H.M. agrees. Yeah, you were done. Peed explains, because they had to carry them to the market. They had to get them while it was cool, pack them and everything, carry them to market in Exmoor. H.M. interjects, getting 10 cents a quart. Peed continues, 10 cents a quart, 10 cents a quart. H.M. chuckles, pick about 10 quarts before you went to school, and you had a dollar. You were doing good. But me, Peed presses on, I used to get by the fastest pickers, my aunt and another guy, right? If they pick 100, I could pick about 80 some. So I had about $8, but we didn't keep all of that money. You had to carry some of that money home. You kept a little bit. Maybe your parents, I take it to my grandmama, because they fed you, bought you clothes and everything. As for the portion Peed kept, I was trying to get that little bit of money before I went to school. That's all there was to it. That girl, you'd go to school and buy her a carton of milk or something. You know what I mean? Or lunch every now and then. You was a man. You was a man. Now, you don't think of strawberries that way. But that's what strawberries are about. And that's why this, you know, it's not just about preserving some cultivar. It's about preserving and playing forward voice in mm-hmm. ways that are here. I know when this came out, I went over to Pete's in his garage kitchen where in winter you can usually find neck bones and green beans on his garage kitchen stove. And I gave him this book, and he looked at this, and he looked at his photos in there, and, you know, he took it right inside. And, you know, it's a powerful thing mm-hmm. for H.M. or Pete or anybody else in this book. A book is a mark of respect that folks don't often see that involves them. It is something that still is really monumental and talismanic in our society. And, you know, that was one of the most important things I learned in doing this.
For the people that are documented here, that are included here, is what were you hoping to accomplish with this? That might have been part of it, but what else?
Well, there were actually two things. One is that I wanted to use this book to begin to get the word out. You know, this place is special. It is a South you never ate, but it's one worth going to the trouble to try and to discover. I also wanted to have a book that certainly would speak to an audience such as this evening, but also one that would speak to folks there. I wanted a book that was first and foremost important to them. I wanted something that meant something to them, because if it didn't mean anything to them, it was just one more academic exercise. It was one more sort of taking things away rather than putting anything back. And so I would take draft chapters to the Oyster House or over to Peed's or at some other place, and I'd read them aloud to people, and they would edit, and they would say, yeah, I like that, or, oh, no, you can't say that. You're going to get me in trouble. And so I go, okay, well, how much trouble you want to get in? He says, well, maybe not that much. And, you know, we'd take that. And I would really try to involve the community as much as I could, one by one, and do, you know, free talks at the local centers and stuff throughout that community. That's what it was back. The other thing is, and this is where you were central to this enterprise, is I wanted to think it all forward, Spike. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to play it forward. And so when it was almost done, I said, this needs a future. I don't want this to be one of those books that looks back nostalgically. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be one more folklorist chasing the past. I want to be the folklorist who chases the future. And so I asked you, Jeremiah Langhorn, Amy Brandt, Ricky Moore, Kevin Callahan, others to take ingredients they knew or a dish that they'd experienced and think it forward. What would it look like for the cook today, the home cook today? And every one of you said yes and created these wonderful suggestions and designs and creations. And each chapter is divided with that view to the future.
I love that. At the same time, there's a part of me that wonders if part of what this book has accomplished, and I'm not sure if this is the case or not, but you've documented something that we may be at risk of losing.
Well,
and maybe if I could just go a little further with that, you've helped us understand the value of this thing, and I think when I've been moved the way that I was as I'm reading this book, the other name that comes to mind for me, it's what's helped me understand a lot about what I'm doing with food, is Wendell Berry. And I put this with a lot of what he's done, in that I now have a heightened sense of what we have and what, if we were to lose it, we would have lost. And that's what has conveyed so incredibly in this book to me. And I don't know if you had that in mind or... Because
there's
a lot of these things are very, we're at risk, I should say. You know, these are fragile systems and fragile things that you're.
I take the point that there's a kind of fragility in there, but there's also an extraordinary vitality. That every story that might drop out of the telling in here is replaced by another story. If you just are. I was just at the Food Lion not so long ago, and the people in front of me and I got into this big discussion about tater cakes, and they were going back and forth about potato cakes, and, you know, this, that, and the other. Well, it turns out they were talking about McDonald's tater cakes. But then they began to realize, as they were talking about that as a kind of benchmark to inferiority, and they were really sort of speaking to memory. And this is now. This is a place that is traditional. Tradition is not about looking back. Tradition is the process of constant invention. Tradition is always the process of making sense for the future. And that runs all through here. And there are folks in this book. I think of the Bennett boys who... I guess, what are they, 10 and 12, who have taken on themselves to start growing figs, keeping a fig library, and who would go on afternoons on their bicycles. This is this past summer, across the highway, without getting mashed, and visit Kemper Goffigan, who was turning 100, who just passed, and would sit with him to hear what was going on. You would think, how unusual, except it's not, is that they were really interested, and they are not. Little Danny Gallivan and his sister, Sophia, they're very much about, you know, sort of listening and, you know, telling stories and carrying it forward. So I'm not in a real hurry to mourn the past here, but rather to... look to a future that is really about a kind of transgenerational respect that is always forward-looking. And that's why this place endures. It doesn't endure. It would have died if it only looked backwards, but it doesn't. It looks to the future.
Well, let's, on that hopeful note, I did my best to inject a little bit of pessimism, but you were not up for it. Let's get some questions.
My question is about the population. You said that it's declining, and you talk about the younger generation of 9 and 10 year olds kind of interested, but I'm thinking of where our house is in Maine and kind of the trouble between the 19 and 40 year olds in terms of sustaining, you know, kind of the infrastructure and the food and all that kind of stuff. Can you address that a minute?
The question is really on target because it's not just Maine, it's not just Eastern Shore Virginia. This is a national problem across the United States. We see, you know, whether it's in the Great Plains, the Midwest, the Northwest, this is what's happening. The issues are what's happening. First, let me characterize. We've had this population loss, but that's not the only demographic factor that's at play here. Is we have in recent years a more rapidly aging population. We have a population where we also that went, I think, around 2000 from roughly 49% African American, 50% Euro American, and 1% Latinx is now changed within 15 years, 10 to 15 years. To roughly 45% Euro-American, 35% African-American, and the remainder is Latinx. The dynamics within those population shifts are distinct, is that we see where an aging population is most acute is actually within the African-American and Euro-American populations. Where it's less pronounced is actually in the new this new wave of Latinx population. The problems there are around educational infrastructure and job creation and job opportunity. This is not a place that's going to become the Silicon Valley or anything like it. It's not going to become the Hamptons. Darn, it might not even become Federal Hill. But the fact of the matter is that there is a path forward, and this takes me back to the what songs does this song place sing best. And I think if we sort of think in those terms is that then we create reasons to stay. Because the one thing we've noticed in the aging population is a large percentage of it are folks who had to go away to work, and then reach a point where they can come back. So that connection is profound. The point is how do you begin to build the bridge? That was an excellent question. Thank you.
If we were driving through, what should we stop and see and do?
It depends on how subtle you want to be. There are things that you can stop and do, and I'm thinking here down below Chincoteague, below Assateague. There are a number of wildlife and refuge areas with hiking trails. Brownsville, which is the Nature Conservancy's preserves, has really well-developed trails around Nassauwacke, where you can actually walk out into the seaside marshes, which is really cool to do. There's the Barrier Island Center at Machapungo, which tells the history of the islands. There are periodically there sort of is an artisan trail. If you're looking for local cuisine, I would always start with the Exmoor Diner. Uh-huh. And look for the it's we're getting there to when they have drum ribs on the menu. I mean, you all know what a spare rib looks like a beef spare rib. They can be 80 to 100 pounds. And What they will do now, and this is actually a delicacy that evolved out of the African-American community, is when they side off the fish, they now save the ribs with the meat on them and break them out and... yes, they fry them, but they get a plate of these fish ribs, which are really quite extraordinary. So there are things to do like that, but I would say if you're interested in the natural world, that's what you can see the most. Shopping, just keep right on going to Virginia Beach.
Other food?
Other food? On Fridays... in Nancock, I think this still happens, is the Glorious Church of Jesus Christ does a takeout, which is really extraordinary. In fact, when I did the last chapter, I called up Spike and said, Spike, I'm going to read you a menu.
Yes.
And I said, what will you comment on this menu? And Spike's response is, are they still serving?
And it was that church,
So there are sorts, there are those kinds of things. There,
go to
number one, Latinx food trucks. People say there is no fine dining on the Eastern Shore of Virginia. Wrong. Food trucks. And I am not kidding. I got it in mind this summer that it would be in my best interest to sample every food truck from Cheriton all the way up to Temperanceville, a place suitably named, in the course of a day, and I would have one gordita at each place. And this, of course, requires folks who are similarly fascinated with excess. And so we did. And it is incredible, is all these wonderful gorditas. So I would say is, you know, every time you see a food truck, pull in, order a gordita. Now, there's a command decision. If you're really looking for sort of diversity, you can get al pastor, chicharrones, or whatever you want. I always think the measure of the food trucks is that you just want to get the same gordita at each one. And so then you really have a basis for taste and discernment and connoisseurship. But yeah, no, the food trucks are just incredible. What else would you add to that?
I was going to say on the other end of this, the Chatham, the only winery on the entire Eastern Shore of Virginia, right, is the Chatham Vineyard, and it's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. They do essentially old school French wines. You wouldn't believe it that they could pull this off, but they really do it. And if the grapes aren't right in a year, they won't have a vintage. Yeah. I've seen them pass on that. But they do on weekends have a wine and oyster plate. So you go there, you get the steel Chardonnay, trust me on this. They will have some of Tom Gallivan's oysters, and they'll shuck them out for you, and you eat those right next to the vineyard.
Talk about really terroir.
Good. Yep. Yeah. Did that help?
He's taking notes, I think.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
Did you grow up there?
There's a story. But, you know, that's the nature of the place. We lived there in the early 50s. My father, who came from Europe as part of the flight of Jews and intellectuals with his parents, got to New York in a very roundabout way. He enlisted, went back, fought in the war. My mother's a native of Norfolk. They met after the war, married, and he wanted to live in a place where it was quiet for once. And my grandfather on my mother's side had an architectural firm, and so he had a bunch of jobs on the Eastern Shore. He had a firm in Norfolk, and so they had a house, and we lived there for several years. And we kept that house after we moved away, but eventually sold it in the 60s. But then we bought a house back again, and my wife and I were married there. And then we sold that because there was no work for somebody like me. And then about 15, 16 years ago, we decided to come back. Now, you would think that having been away all that time, people would forget. But they publish the property transactions in the paper. And it's published, and I wake up and there's an email. And this is what it says. And I quote, "We see you're coming back." And I had to allow us how that was true. But yeah, it was very much of a formative place for me, is that, and I've kept that association. For a long time, I thought growing up in the South was something of a disease I could overcome. But no, it's, you can't. You know, it's there. This place especially is just so extraordinarily poetical. And, you know, one reviewer of this described it as a love letter to this place. And I don't disagree with that.
We're going to tag team on this
one. You can go ahead and ask.
Yeah. So this area is facing a double whammy of geologically land sinking, and there's nothing to be done about that. And because of climate change, the water level, which means rising. So it's got a double whammy for sea level rise. And I'm wondering about what you think about the vulnerability of this community and what people think about that, and what you see as the main sources of resilience to that.
My question was simpler. Is it, will you survive 12 inches of sea level rise?
If I could answer that with just unequivocal certainty, I'd have a different job. But all things being equal, yes, I think, again, it will change. But it's a place that's always been marked by change. You know, it's easy to think of it as being static, and it's not. You know, yes, we're seeing, like, accelerated erosion in certain areas, but we're also seeing accelerated buildup in others. We're seeing drowned forests in certain areas. So that, yes, this is a very real threat. It's a very real change. The big changes to look for are actually going to be in ocean chemistry. You know, we tend to think of sea level rise and the impact on land. Sea level rise means the sea is being diluted. It also means that the temperature bands are shifting, and the zones are very different already from what they are. And that kind of change is one that I think people just don't have a handle on. There's a lot of denial. What's interesting there is there are folks who don't want to believe that climate change is caused by humans, but boy, they believe wholeheartedly in climate change, and they see sea level rise every day. How that gets addressed, I don't know. Many thousand years ago, the area was a desert, and the Chesapeake Bay was a trickle that came off the Susquehanna that came down. There was nothing there at all. In a sort of a kind of geological resignation, it's going to change. And whether it survives, if the measure of survival is humankind, which is a low bar, probably it will struggle, but eventually the sea will take it back. If the bar is set higher, will there be a kind of enduring place in its most basic geological sense? Yes, I think there will be a place. It just won't look anything like it looks now. So, but, you know, that's, you know, I'm a folklorist, not a geologist or scientist.
Hi. I was curious about, because it was such a prosperous community, how many of those, I guess, old families do you think are still around, or families who have been there for many, many generations?
They are there. When you say old families, as our mind immediately goes to sort of white plantation elites, and there's that. But there are also African-American families that have been around every bit as long and whose genealogies are every bit as complex. They are all very, very close together. But to give you an example, is that when I go over to the Bayford Oyster House, sometimes I'll run into Major Jones. Major is his name, not his rank. And Major is, well, I guess Major is about 40, 45 now. And I point out to him that, Major, you know that on that farm where you live, that was owned by Major Jones in the 1640s. And so you have some of that. But you also have folks, all those wonderful seaside families, the Terrys and the Cobbs, they all came down with a southern migration out of New England in the 1890s and married in. So it's complicated, but, I think if they sent we sent everybody's tissue sample to 23andMe, it would come back and it would look amazingly like the Eastern Shore, with great depth of family. But the greater depth is not gene; it's genetic. The greater depth is memory.
We can talk about oyster pie.
Talk about oyster pie. What do you?
Well, we've kind of shared. I felt like that's been something we've bonded over in the past.
That's true.
And I was trying to get ready to, because we're going to get ready to eat, and it's going to be the first thing we get to try tonight is oyster pie. We did it in honor of your return, and I'm very excited to share that with you.
Excellent. Yeah, we were talking earlier today about oyster pie. Oyster pie, I'm pretty sure, is, if not the, one of the oldest dishes in continuous circulation in British North America. The earliest recipes to oyster pies appear in Elizabethan farce. And there are recipes for oyster pies that show up in the 1700s in English cookery manuals. Well, it turns out if you look at those and you start looking around, is that you find that people on the Eastern Shore, especially on the seaside, make oyster pies. And it's one of those things nobody gave any thought to. It was like drumhead stew. Nobody here makes that stuff. And then you discover is that everybody makes this fish stew, baked fish chowder. But oyster pies are a dish that is closely associated with the poverty cuisine. The one thing that you could get were oysters, and they would make a lean crust, you would layer it full of oysters, and then you would make a lattice top. Now, this is the part you probably aren't ready for, is that an oyster pie, if you had a carrot, that was like a major deal. That was a step up if you could put, like, some carrot into your oyster pie or some onion, because oysters were free. And so a perfect oyster pie for folks here is solid oysters. I mean, it is like a packed oyster tureen. But who can afford that? And you start to think about this. And so now is that what we see is that, again, you have to modify. You have to invent and
build out.
We've
modified a little bit.
And I'll tell you right now is that, just haven't eaten a panned oyster dish from that I do that's based on an 1880s recipe.
I had that. Yeah.
Is a lot of oysters. A very, 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 very long way. They actually really appreciate the company of that carrot.
Well, I want to thank you for this book. I want to thank you for your work. 12 years in the making, right?
Yeah. I want to thank you. I want to thank Dana for being back here, and Hannah and Lauren for everything that you've done. Most of all, I want to thank you all for being here this evening, and you were very polite. But I know you came for the food, as I would have done. Stories and food absolutely go together. Don't do both at the same time.
Well, we'll go ahead. About the menu, or do you want to just let this cost? No, we have a spectacular menu inspired by the book. Lauren Sandler has been cooking all day. We started out with clams and sweet potatoes and fritters, which play an important role here. We've got red drum. I think, Joe, did you bring that?
Yes.
Yes. Where was that from?
Down by Rudy Inlet, the south end of Virginia Beach. So we're still within the parameters of our travels in Atlantic.
Well, they're a migratory fish.
Right.
Yeah.
And you said, black drum was, we were too, it's too early in the season for black drum. Sheep's head,
a few more temperature changes in the water before we see any of them yet. But they're great eating.
Yeah, I'll say something about sheep's head. There's actually a poetical description from 1816 of the Norfolk Seafood Market. And the most prized fish in 1816 in the lower Chesapeake was the sheep's head.
Great.
Yeah, well, you just have to come back, because I know that there will be sheep's head on the menu here soon enough.
There will, and I'm so inspired by this. We've got we're going to kind of reinvigorate the dumplings that we do at Woodbury based on this book and what you've written here. And we have greens, we have corn mush, as I think we would call it, and we have sweet potato pie for dessert. So we started with sweet potato, we're going to end with sweet potato. Thank you. We are going to abandon ship here out of this room so we can turn it and have dinner. Thank you, guys.
Thank you all.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.
Restaurants across the country are in need of support as a result of the devastating effects COVID-19 is having on this industry. If we don't help now, some of our favorite community gathering spaces may not be there when this crisis is over. Restaurant Opportunities Center United has compiled a list of local resources supporting the restaurant industry from cities and states across the country. From North Carolina's Triangle Area Restaurant Workers Resources to Nebraska's COVID-19 Response Fund, Minnesota's Immigrant Family Fund, Georgia's Giving Kitchen, and many, many more, we can all find a cause to support. Visit rockunited.org/relief. That's rocunited.org/relief to find a list of national, state, and local resources.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.